Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada. It's a scorcher up here tonight, 94 degrees. And we're broadcasting from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Crime Beat this evening is delighted and thrilled to announce the appearance of Terry Tariba, author of Mickey Cohen, The Life and Crimes of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster. Ms. Tariba will discuss Mickey Cohen's life and provide insights into the history of L.A.'s deadly crime scene. In the second half of our broadcast, Crime Beat brings you officials John Pappas and Patrick Fleming of Poker Players Alliance. The online poker advocates will discuss recent developments affecting the multi-billion dollar online gambling industry. It's going to be a great show. More about them in just a few minutes. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director-publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and his real in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Now, take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer, broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out early next year. This fall, he'll publish with Ellie Warner, another best-selling author, a book about the famous Nalva shipwreck that sank 100 years ago. In Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Like I said, you're getting great at those promos, and you're pushing our books. That's good. Well, you know what? The book is almost sold out, and it's coming out on ebook form this fall. Well, I'll tell you, Ronnie, we're also going to be appearing likely on a teleconference at the Squatch Berry Literary Festival in Geraldton, Ontario. It's going to be a fun. It's going to be a fun thing. So anyway, we'll invite all our people. If you're in the area in Geraldton, Ontario, come by and pay us a visit. Now, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we've received, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. There's no turning back the clock now, Ronnie. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week, and it's growing, and it's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Kyle tonight, who's stepping in for Corey, and also thanking Scott and Tony for making this show possible. Like I said many times, Ronnie Boy, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, here's this week's mailbag. This one is from Emily of Little Rock, Arkansas. Emily writes, I just finished reading William Deere's book, O.J. is Innocent, and I can prove it. I read it after listening to your guest last week. He was so convincing during the broadcast that O.J. was not the killer that I went out and bought the book. It was a compelling read, pointing the finger at Jason Simpson. I'm telling you, is the LAPD blind? They have to revisit the case for the sake of justice. But you know what? I won't hold my breath. Any comments to that, Ronnie?
Yeah, you know, it's circumstantial evidence, which Mr. Dear God, but the real shocking thing is they never interviewed Jason Simpson and the LAPD, and the case was laid out for William Deer, who about Jason Simpson, who he thinks is the killer, and OJ's protecting. I really don't buy that argument, but he has a lot of compelling evidence that has to be looked at, and that's all I think that we could ask LAPD to do, is to look at this evidence, but they won't talk to him, and they won't reopen the case.
Well, and, I'll tell you, maybe our show is going to spark something, because Mr. Deer was a great guest, and he had a lot of things to say about this case.
Right.
So it was a great book too. I really enjoyed it. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show?
Yes, next week is documentary show, which we have occasionally. We're featuring two documentarians. Tommy Reed's going to talk about his book, Super Thief. A gentleman named Carl Christopher, who pulled off the biggest bank robbery in history. And then the other is an interesting book, documentary by director Varij Luhavny, Genocide Revealed, and he talks about the Ukrainian Holocaust, where Stalin killed 10 million Ukrainians in 1932-1933. So it's going to be a very interesting educational show.
Absolutely. Not too many people know about that horrific epoch in history. It's going to I'll look forward to that one, since you and I are Ukrainian background.
Right.
Now, Ronnie, thanks for that. Tell us what you're up to and what you're going to be doing in the next couple of weeks.
Well, we got honorable mention at the Philadelphia International Film Festival in the Market for the documentary Frank Matthews.
Hey, bravo.
Right, thank you. I was on Prison World Radio to discuss the Frank Matthews doc, and I'm going to be on Outlaw Crime, Burl Bear's really great crime show this Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So people want to tune in and go to www.outlawcrime.com. Willie?
Well, that's great, Ronnie. Good luck on that side. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the Beat to Crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here is this week's rap sheet. Rap sheet item, Dateline, June 25th, 2012. Providence, Rhode Island. Marijuana decriminalization efforts to relax pot rules gaining momentum in the United States. Hey, Ronnie, once consigned to the political fringe, marijuana policy is appearing on legislative agendas around the United States, thanks to a real, energized base of supporters. Any comments on that? Things are changing, man.
Yeah, man. I mean, 17 states and District of Columbia now authorize medical marijuana, and 14 other states, including Connecticut and Massachusetts, have rolled back criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of pot. Just a couple of days ago, Chicago passed a law making marijuana possession a misdemeanor. And it's really incredible. I haven't read any articles discussing why this sudden change, because it's not the most liberal of times. But it seems to be that, and a Gallup poll supports it, the majority of Americans support legalization of marijuana, which, of course, we both agree should be done, because we think the war on drugs is a complete failure. And it's the failure symbolized, of course, by the way marijuana is treated by the law. Willie?
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's gaining momentum in the United States, and curiously enough, it's losing ground in Canada with the conservative government. But that'll change. That'll change. Well, now, just before we get on to our first featured guest, Terry Tariba, author of Mickey Cohen, The Life and Crimes of L.A.'s Notorious Monster, will take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network, World Radio Network, where you're here tonight. We hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on the Internet Band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guests, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Roddy, Crime Beat's first featured guest tonight is Terry Tariba. She'll talk about her fascinating book titled Mickey Cohen, The Life and Crimes of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Terry Tariba.
I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I did some research on you. I think we should just talk about your background. It's just fascinating. And I tell you, I was taken back when I saw that picture of Jim Morrison of The Doors and You. and his girlfriend, Pamela. And I did a little more research, and you have a tremendous background. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, Andy Warhol is in there, Martin Scorsese, Sam Spielberg. Summarize our background for you, for us.
Well, you know, it's an L.A. background, and it's, you know, what happens when you live off the Sunset Strip. You know, you meet these fascinating people that, you know, are just part of, it's not unlike what Mickey Cohen's life was, except, you know, I have a straight life and he has a gangster life. But the one that I was very close to, the closest to, was Andy Warhol, who, you know, was, in a way, a father figure for me from the time I was a teenager into my 30s. And I've had, you know, an amazing life, and I do think, you know, you can only have this life, you know, coming from a place like L.A. or New York City, you know, these kinds of things just happen to you.
Right. Well, you got, like, a really fascinating life, but you took 10 years out of it to write about Mickey Cohen, right?
Well,
why did you decide to write about organized crime figure like Mickey Cohen?
Well, it was 10 years of research, and you know, it wasn't 10 years every minute of my life.
But it was an extraordinary amount of research,
and it needed it. I wanted to know about the LA underworld, and no one had ever really written about it in depth. You had The Last Mafioso by Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano, which is, you know, his version of things. You've had James Ellroy's fiction, which is his version of things, and it is, you know, highly fictionalized and, you know, comes from a very fertile imagination and, you know, doesn't pretend to be anything but fiction. And no one had ever broached the L.A. underworld. And so I, just on my own, for the fun of it, started digging into my own library and looking, you know, for different names and things that, you know, would define this for me. Now, remember, I, you know, had spent a life in all these neighborhoods that are a part of my book. And so why does no one know really about the L.A. underworld? Well, it had been suppressed because so much of it, you know, in the beginning, gangsters and cops and politicians of Los Angeles were synonymous. This is all something that, you know, people wanted to hide, the authorities wanted to hide, and then organized crime was brought to L.A. with Bugsy Siegel and, you know, then Mickey Cohen, who was born in Brooklyn, but was brought here at age 2 and has no memories of anywhere else but Los Angeles. So Mickey Cohen is my protagonist because he can take you from his boyhood when Los Angeles was being run by politicians and, you know, the people who were in business with them, who were the racketeers, and the police, who were also, you know, part of the rackets, when he was a boy, all the way to 1976.
Right.
I wanted to know, and so it took 10 years, and it took this book to find out. And now we have a definitive book that can tell that you'll learn about the L.A. underworld.
Right. Well, so what does your book tell us that some other books on Mickey Cohen don't tell us? You know, some of the new research that you gathered.
Well, you know, there really hasn't been a book that the books that were out before were, Mickey Cohen had a book that came out a year before he died, and it's a book that tells the stories the way he wants them told. You know, since he, you know, was definitely in business with police also and politicians, they all had to corroborate on certain stories. And until my book, the underworld really hasn't been named. I named the names of the players in the underworld that were part of Mickey Cohen's outfit. I named the people that were his enemies. I named the people that played him, actually That happened too. I name his mentors the big syndicated crime bosses. I'm the first person that actually does this. And, you know, I use FBI files, you know, rare documents, California Crime Commission, Favre hearings, McClellan hearings. I have rare documents. I have
rare photos.
Like, you know, you see all
excellent
of them
photos.
For the first
nice.
Time. You see photos of Mickey Cohn's outfit, you know, and you see all the players of the L.A. underworld. These names, like, say, Jimmy Utley, who was his arch enemy and second most important gangster in California, according to the California Crime Commission, who's ever heard of Jimmy Utley? You know, really.
That's true. But, you know, your book really points this out, that he was a major mover and shaker in shaping the organized crime world of the West, particularly L.A. But, you know, he's not as well known as some of the other criminals in history like Al Capone. How do you explain that? Because he is a colorful character, and, you know, he was all over the map during, you know, much of his life.
Well, what's amazing is he was headline news and the most famous, by the way, Al Capone was his idol and role model. Al Capone was, you know, 14 years older and his idol and role model. Mickey Cohn was all over the papers, you know, from the mid-40s until his death. When he died in 1976, the New York Times devoted a complete page to him, for his obituary.
Right.
Took up a complete page in the New York Times.
Right.
I mean, this wasn't in the New York Post. He was the most talkative and talked about organized crime figure for a generation. But, you know, history often... people disappear from history. But,
right.
You know, he had the most, he was the most outrageous, he was the most brazen, he had all of the major syndicated crime figures as his mentors, and, you know, he had most unique and wild ride of a life. Had 11 assassination attempts, two of them actually on the Sunset Strip, several of them in Brentwood, later home of O.J.,
right.
And scene
right.
of the Nicole Brown, Ron Goldman killings, including a giant bombing of his home where
right.
everyone, you know, survived unscathed. There was a war, a gang war going on from 1945 to about 1950 because Mickey Cohn brought in his own mafia family from Cleveland. And you know, when Bugsy Siegel was assassinated, he, you know, took over and ignored the existing mafia family of Jack Dragna. Jack Dragna, you know, Bugsy Siegel had respected him because Tommy Lucchese was his relative. But he was ineffectual, and when Siegel was dead, Mickey Cohn, you know, disrespected him and essentially shoved him out of the action and cut off the wire service.
I got a question for Terry, Ronnie. You know, we were talking about assassinations, and when Jack Kennedy was assassinated, it's no secret that the Kennedys and Cohen knew each other. What did he think about that particular situation, about that killing, and also when Robert Kennedy was killed? Any comments on that?
Well, you know, Mickey Cohn was in jail for tax evasion and had been suffered irreparable damage after he was attacked by a crazed prisoner in Atlanta. Not long after he was transferred from Alcatraz to Atlanta. And so he was in prison. Robert Kennedy essentially made sure that they finally got him. In Los Angeles, he had been tried for everything from disturbing the peace to murder, and they were never able to get him. So this was Robert Kennedy sent him up on the second tax evasion term. He was put in Alcatraz like Capone, and then amazingly, Mickey Cohn became the only person ever bailed out of Alcatraz. Mm. And amazingly, his bail was signed by a sitting Supreme Court judge. That shows you how much clout he had.
Right. And Willie, let's take a...
But let me get into Robert Kennedy. So he and Robert Kennedy were at war, essentially, because he put him back in jail. And I always felt that there was something going on, because Robert Kennedy was shot in the Ambassador Hotel, where Mickey Cohn had many ties. He had a casino there at one time, an illegal casino. He often stayed there, and he also had many ties to the Wilshire Precinct, which was where the Ambassador Hotel was. Sirhan had worked at Santa Anita Racetrack, which was, of course, his Cohn's stronghold, and many of the lawyers who had represented Mickey Cohn became the lawyers for Sirhan Sirhan. He also had very close ties to Carlos Marcello, you know, and I just feel that it's too much of a coincidence for Mickey Cohn not to have been somehow involved. You know, it's a circumstantial case. He's sitting in prison, crippled, but the streets of L.A. were still run by Mickey Cohn through surrogates, and that's where Robert Kennedy died.
Willie, let's take a quick station break, and we'll be back with our guest.
You bet. What a fascinating interview. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and Will Hrib. Now back to Tara Tariba and Ron.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with Tara Tariba, author of Mickey Cohn, The Life and Times of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster. You can go to her website, terrytariba.com. That's spelled T-E-R-E-T-E-R-E-B-A.com. Or you go to our website, the Artist First website, to get more information on her. And the book's everywhere, right, Tariba?
Yeah, it's everywhere. Mickey Cohn book is a very good place to go, too, because then you don't have to remember how to spell my name. M-I-C-K-E-Y-C-O-H-E-N book.com. It's available everywhere, and it's available as an e-book. It's available in hardcover, paperback, and, you know, it's out there.
Right. And wish I had a name like Mickey Cohn to use, too, for my name. But let's get back to our interview, this fascinating interview. And I've read the book, and we're just going to touch the surface, so I recommend that you buy it, because it gives a lot of information on L.A. and one of its most fascinating characters, Mickey Cohn. Mickey was described as a born hustler. He was illiterate, unable to count before he was 5 until he was nearly 30. I read one account.
Beyond 5. He wasn't able to count beyond 5.
Yeah, beyond 5 until he was nearly 30. And, you know, I heard him described as a sociopath and very violent. Describe Mickey Cohn. What did your research show him to be as a gangster and as a person?
Mickey Cohn, you know, was outrageous and dangerous. And, you know, he always wanted to improve himself. He was a wild, obsessive, compulsive. He washed his hands more than maybe 100 times a day. He wouldn't touch anything unless he had a Kleenex in his hand. He showered several times a day for more than an hour. He spent much of his life servicing these obsessions. He was also obsessed with animals, his pets. He was obsessed with hats, socks, fine clothing, ice cream. Yeah. He was addicted to ice cream. You know,
he lived
a Hollywood life. And what was amazing, Mickey Cohn was the finest actor in Hollywood. He could, you know, make anybody, you know, he knew how to read people like no one in the world. A lawyer told me that was, he felt, his greatest ability. And, you know, if he was meeting the press, he'd act for them. If he was, you know, meeting Shirley Temple, who, you know, wrote about him in her autobiography, you know, he made the impression that for Shirley Temple. you know, if it was Sinatra, he manipulated Sinatra in the way he wanted, you know, to. He really knew how to work it, and he lived the wildest Hollywood life. This is like he started off, you know, as an illiterate newsboy, then he moved to professional boxer, then he moved to thug, then he moved to mobster, then he moved to mob boss and celebrity. He was, you know, as I said, in the mid-century, he was, you know, the most talked about and written about mobster ever.
Well, you mentioned, you know, Sinatra and Shirley Temple, and there are other names like Billy Graham, which is just amazing. He's associated with Billy Graham and Tricky Dick Nixon. What's his association with Billy Graham? Just briefly give a connection with Mickey on that.
Well, Reverend Billy Graham, Mickey Cohn was in the headlines almost every day of 1949. It was a year of tumultuous activity in Los Angeles. He essentially brought down the chief of police. The mayor almost fell. You know, the California Crime Commission was instituted by the state of California because of Mickey Cohn's activities. There were so many assassination attempts going on, including one on the Sunset Strip where a number of citizens were hit and killed beside gangsters. And Mickey Cohn was that night guarded by not only his gangster bodyguards, but a bodyguard assigned by the state attorney general. Mm-hmm. And so Billy Graham saw that Mickey Cohn had a lot of press. And he was in Los Angeles, and this was where he was getting his major attention. He was a rising star, Billy Graham. From North Carolina, he was an evangelical Christian, and you know he was giving his first big, you know, meetings, you know, and that they ran nearly 3 months, and Hearst papers were pushing him. They had been pushing Mickey Cohn, and he was the antithesis of Mickey Cohn, and so the two of them sort of got together. Mickey Cohn was looking for good publicity because he'd been in the headlines with all these scandals and, you know, shootouts and everything else, you know, the war of the Sunset Strip. And Billy Graham, very ambitious, was looking for somebody of a major name to catapult him into the headlines and keep him there. So, you know, they met and it was a mutual, they were using each other mutually. And Mickey Cohn then the next year, in 1950, he was again in the headlines with the Kefauver testimony, which I have part of it in my book, Mickey Cohn actually talking about his life and businesses to Senator Kefauver and two other senators. The deposition is there, and the next year he served, you know, his first major conviction, first felony conviction. He was sent to McNeil Island for tax evasion.
Right.
Then he comes out, and Billy Graham connects with him again.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, that's really, that's just one of the anecdotes that are in your book, and I recommend that book for our readers, because it's just fascinating, because we're just going to touch the surface of the book. And we're finishing up here, and I wanted to ask you about the Gangster Squad, which our listeners may not know about. There's a movie coming out starring Sean Penn, and it's supposed to be about Mickey Cohn. Are you having anything to do with that, and how that's going to affect your book?
Well, I don't have anything.
And we got about 1 minute.
I don't have anything to do with it. It's about cops in like the late 40s. You know, I think it's, you know, like you know, taking like L.A. Confidential to the next step, and they're going after, you know, L.A.'s Capone, Mickey Cohn. Sean Penn is playing him, and I look forward to seeing it with my container of popcorn, and it has a terrific cast, and I think it'll be great.
Yeah, I think your book will probably benefit from you know, from the movie coming out, and we wish you success with your book. It's a great read. We recommend it to our listeners. You can see we just touched the surface. We wanted to talk about his relationship with Bugsy Siegel and the LA Underworld, but you'll get that in Terry's book. And the book, again, is Mickey Cohen, The Life and Times of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster.
The Life and Crimes of L.A.'s Notorious.
Yeah, The Life and Times of L.A.'s
Crimes,
Notorious
Life and Crimes.
Excuse me, Life and Crimes here. I've got a typo here in my thing. Of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster. And we hope that you have success with the book, and we'd like to see you back on the show sometime for your next book, which I hope is about organized crime, because you're a great writer.
Thank you so much.
Great read, Terry. It was a great book. A great book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we'll take a brief station break, Willie.
Yeah, we're going to take a brief station identification. We're going to get Kyle to hook up on our guests. So take it away, Kyle, and we'll be back after this musical interlude.
First Radio Network.
Yeah, I saw that email. I haven't talked to him, but I'm sure will soon.
Okay.
Now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network.
Okay, thanks, Kyle. Tonight on our second half, we bring you Poker Alliance officials John Pappas and Patrick Fleming of Poker Players Alliance. They're going to discuss the recent developments affecting online gambling, this multi-billion dollar industry. So stick around. You won't want to miss this interview. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, John Pappas and Patrick Fleming.
Good evening.
Yes,
good evening.
And
thank you for having us on.
Thank you. And briefly, the purpose of your organization and how many members you got.
The Poker Players Alliance is a grassroots advocacy organization. Our mission is to advocate for reasonable laws and regulations to enable Americans to play poker in their own homes, at bars and taverns, at charity events, and even on the Internet. So we have a membership of about 1.2, 1.3 million members, continuing to grow. Our single issue is to advocate for the game of poker for the people who play it.
Right. And you were on last June, and that was almost a couple of months after Black Friday, April 15, 2011. That's what it's known in the poker online poker community. I've read where the members of your organization have expressed frustration both at having their funds frozen on the website accounts and their inability to play online poker on a credible site. Is that still the case today?
It's partially the case. There were three sites that were affected by Black Friday, four if you count them that way. That was PokerStars, Full Tilt Poker, and the Sirius Network, which included Ultimate Bet and Absolute Poker. The very unfortunate thing as we speak is that the players who had money on the Sirius Network and, more surprisingly, players who had money on Full Tilt Poker are still waiting to get reimbursed for their balances. Thankfully, the largest poker site, PokerStars, was able to reimburse every one of its players in full shortly after, well, shortly, but within a few weeks after Black Friday. So PokerStars players have received all of their funds, but the players on the other two networks so far have not.
Well, how much money are we
talking
about?
And that is a source of great frustration.
How much money are we talking about that's still owed?
Well, just on the just on Full Tilt Poker alone, it's estimated somewhere north of $150 million of U.S. players' money and over $300 million of what they call the rest of the world. So, you know, it's a substantial sum of money. I think the money is considerably less on the Sirius network. But, you know, to your second point, is they don't have the access to money, but they also don't really have access to the games, particularly like they had access to the games before April 15th of last year. And for those who were making their living playing poker online, and believe it or not, there were people making a substantial living, but then also people making, you know, some supplemental income online as well, those livelihoods have been literally devastated, and in some cases, the players have left the country to continue playing.
Well, my first question was, how many players does this affect? Do you think? And number two, what about the rest of the world? Is it like the same situation as America's, or is it different?
No, I'll answer the first question. It affected millions, tens of, or I'd say approximately anywhere between 6 to 10 million on Americans had online poker accounts. So anybody who had money online that affected it and was playing on these sites, they were affected. Now, how many of those are professional players? I would say on our estimates are about 4% of our membership. So 4% of the PPA 1.2 million membership consider themselves a professional player. So the numbers aren't in the millions, of course, of professional players, but, you know, several tens of thousands of professional players were affected by this. The rest of the world has a completely different attitude. The U.S. has got a backwards approach to Internet gaming and Internet poker, where they're trying to prohibit it. Obviously, Congress is hopefully moving in a different direction now, but and states certainly are moving in a different direction. But the rest of the world has embraced the idea of regulation of internet gaming, not just poker. You know, major countries like Italy, France, Belgium, Germany, others are regulating this activity, and they are reaping the benefits of not only you know, credible actors operating within their borders, but strong consumer protections for the players and revenue.
Right. How do you explain this difference between the U.S. and the rest of the world when it comes to online gambling?
Politics. Take it away, John.
that was my next question. I mean, we'll talk about that, but why? I mean, hostility towards online gambling?
It's a bit about politics, and it's a bit about I think, culture. I mean, believe it or not, you know, there's not a lot of brick-and-mortar casinos throughout Europe, but online gambling is very prevalent. I think that they're just more willing to embrace, you know, technological advances than anything. And when we talk about, you know, 4G, I mean, in Europe they had 4G over a year ago, years ago. So we're somewhat behind when it comes to embracing different technologies here in the U.S. And, of course, there is a political element to it. You know, we have a section of our political environment here that is very anti-gambling. While they may speak out of one voice about personal freedom and personal responsibility, in their second voice, they're talking about, well, only personal freedom and personal responsibility when it's things that we like. So it's a very interesting dynamic we have here in America, but I think we're actually changing the tide, and I think not only because the politics is changing, but I think the rest of America is waking up to the idea of why would we be prohibiting this? If people want to do it, they should be able to do it in a safe and regulated environment.
Does this divide over online gambling, does that reflect the divisiveness that we see in Congress too? Like we have Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other, and there's no way to make anything work?
Well, I mean, I think the inability of getting a bill done is because of the divisiveness. But, I mean, if you'll note, the lead sponsors of the bills in the House of Representatives are both Republicans. So I think we've done a good – that's Joe Barton from Texas.
Right.
And who is a social – we call himself – he would call himself a social conservative. And John Campbell from California, who would probably call himself a more of a libertarian. But they are both registered Republicans, and they are and they have and the bills have a number of Republican supporters on the bill. So I think we've done a very good job of bridging the gap between the aisles on this. I think this has become more of a bipartisan issue, and really what's holding it up is just the inability of Congress to get anything done.
Well, you mentioned the who are leading Democrats that are backing your position.
Sure. Well, Barney Frank has been a longtime supporter, and sadly, Barney Frank is retiring this after the end of this congressional session. But there are several others. Rep Larson from Connecticut, who's in Democratic leadership, has been very supportive. Steve Cohen from Tennessee has been very supportive. Steve Israel, another Republican Democrat in the leadership, has been very supportive. And most importantly, on the Senate side, we have someone like Senator Harry Reid, who's really taking up the effort over there.
Right. Well, that's a mix of people. What about people that are strongly against online gambling? Who are some of those people that are in opposition to your position?
Well, they're equal opportunists, because not only do they oppose online gambling, they oppose all gambling. And those would be people like Bob Goodlatte from Virginia and Frank Wolf from Virginia. Notice the Virginia ties there. But also, there are some in what they would call the Values Action Caucus within the U.S. Congress, which is made up primarily of very socially conservative House Republicans.
Right.
Those are people that just believe that gambling is immoral. And, we've tried to work with those individuals to explain that, hey, this is going on whether you like it or not. Would it be better done in a regulated environment than an unregulated environment where people can be taken advantage of? Children may have access to the sites without, appropriate age restrictions. And all of the, perceived ills of Internet gambling are magnified when it's unregulated. Even still, they're not moved by those arguments. They'd rather see it unregulated in all 50 states than having their stamp of approval on it in even one state.
Yeah, on that same vein, gentlemen, a lot of your opponents speak about the insidious nature of gambling, addiction, and how online poker and gambling is the cause and effect of addiction with this activity. How do you really answer that question? How do you answer to your critics on that?
Well, there are two answers, really. First of all, one of the things that we do at the Poker Players Alliance and really try and stress strongly is that there's quite a distinction between poker and what most people traditionally consider gambling. Most people traditionally think of slot machines and blackjack and games you play against, quote-unquote, the house, the games you play against the casino, where the casino always has an edge and the games are predominantly determined by chance and the mathematics of the games are set up so the casino always wins. So that's one factor, because poker is very different from that. Poker is not a game you play against the casino or against the house. Poker is a game we play against each other. We match our skills against other poker players. We're more like chess players and tennis players and World of Warcraft players and other kinds of games where people compete against each other. And that's an important difference, because in the realm of gambling addiction, one finds that those kind of person-to-person competitions, where skill is an important element, are not really the kind of games that appeal to most people who have gambling problems or gambling addictions. So point number one is to remember that poker is very different from those other forms of gambling. In fact, one of my roles at the PPA is to emphasize the fact that poker really shouldn't be considered gambling, because it's a game of player against player in which skill is the predominant factor. So that's the first point. It's very important to separate poker from those other considerations, because poker doesn't lead to the problems that those other types of gambling do lead to. And the other point is that the studies are now relatively consistent. You know, England has had online gambling perfectly legal for almost a decade now. And the UK has seen no increase in problem gambling as a result of the fact that they've allowed gambling to occur online. In fact, the experts in the field are starting to come to a consensus now that it's really not that, you know, there's really not a lot of people out there who are not who have a gambling addiction but haven't realized it because they don't have an opportunity to gamble. Gambling of some kind or another is freely available almost everywhere in the entire world. So the idea that if you allow people to play online, all of a sudden you're going to create new gambling addicts just isn't really true. The statistics and the studies show that the prevalence of gambling problems and gambling addicts stays relatively the same when you introduce new forms of gambling. And the biggest study in the United Kingdom, as I said, showed virtually no increase in problem gambling or gambling addiction in the 10 years that they've allowed online gambling. So those are our two answers to those critics. You're really not saving anybody from anything by opposing legalization and regulation. All you're doing is forcing the people who choose to engage in that activity to engage in it in a much less safe environment. And finally, as I'm sure John is about to chop in, that if you're really concerned about people who have gambling problems and gambling addiction, the way to control that is through a regulated environment where you can identify these people, where you can reach out to these people, offer them help with their problems and their addictions. You can require the gambling sites, once they are legal, regulated, and responsible to authorities, to engage in those activities. So actually, by bringing it out from the black or gray market and putting it into an open market that is regulated and watched by the authorities, you actually deal much better with the people who have gambling problems and gambling addictions.
Right. You said it perfectly, Patrick. I wouldn't change a thing.
Okay, right. Great answer.
Of course, with regulation, too, there's the possibility of taxed income, right? You know, making some money for the coffers as well as providing for a safe environment.
That's absolutely true. It's not going to solve our national deficit, but every
Billy,
little bit
in the
helps,
right direction.
Right?
Yeah, more money coming in than money going out to help.
No,
it
certainly will, and it's not to be overlooked. Not only is there going to be revenue that comes in, but also, you know, we're talking about the internet here, and the U.S. should be at the leading edge of the internet economy, no matter what it is, and we're well behind now. I mean, if you know, the great minds in Silicon Valley were able, and we have great minds there, operating games like Zynga and some other social gaming, if they could, you know, apply those games to the real money environment. Right. In a regulated way, I think, you know, the U.S. could be the leader in this industry, and I think, you know, we have the amount of players here, we have the brain power to have the best software and the best customer service here in the U.S. I think the U.S. would really lead the world when it comes to this industry, and I think that means only more revenue, more job creation, and more good things for the U.S. that would certainly outweigh any of the potential social costs.
You frequently refer to a safe environment. Can you briefly summarize some of the threats when you have an unregulated environment on the internet that comes to gambling?
Sure. Well, I think you know, we touched on one earlier, is the fact that, you know, one of these sites or a few of these sites were forced to shut down and unable to pay back the players. So one of the requirements in a regulated environment would be that the sites would actually have to keep all player deposits separate from other monies that the company operates with, so that when you deposit money on the site, whenever you want that money, the site has that money on hand and can send it back to you. And that wasn't the case, obviously, and many people are out millions of dollars because of this. You know, other safeguards would be, you know, proactive auditing of the websites that are operating to ensure that the sites are doing everything right to ensure the integrity of the game, so that they have the softwares in place to ensure that the deal is a fair deal, that the deal is random, that the outcomes are random. So that's very important as well for player protection. And there's a whole litany of other player protections that we can put in place, including stop loss limits for players, so that they can say, you know what, I only want to spend $100 a month, or $100 a week playing online. And once you reach that point, you wouldn't be able to deposit the $101st dollar, things like that. So there's a lot of
a lot of things that can be done. Both Willie and I have played a game of poker or two, but there may be a lot of listeners out there that may not be familiar with online poker. Why should they care about this issue if they're not directly involved with online gambling?
Well, I'll speak at first, and Patrick can weigh in. But
we only got about 4 minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about this Neverfold campaign before we go off the air. So. Go ahead,
Peter. Sure. I'll be quick. I mean, this is a litmus test, I think, for other issues. If government's going to come into your home and tell you that you can't spend your money on your computer playing, a $2 poker tournament, then really what's next? And so I think this is really kind of government internet censorship in a very refined way. And I think anybody who's concerned about the overreach of government into the personal lives of Americans should be really appalled by what's happened in the past, and will be supportive of a regulatory framework in the future.
Right. Now, you have a Never Fold campaign, right, this past April 15, 2012. And you've got been doing some other things. Can you just, we got like 2 minutes, can you summarize some of the things that you've been doing, and how somebody out there in the audience that may be interested in the issue, how they can get involved?
Sure. Well, the Never Fold campaign was a kind of a one-year anniversary, wouldn't call it a celebration, but a reminder of the poker community that here we are 1 year later, and the players are never going to fold. The players who want to play online are still going to continue to advocate for their rights, and it's very easy for a player to become involved, whether you're a poker player or someone who's interested in this issue. Simply come to the PPA website, which is theppa.org. And if you want to go to theppa.org/neverfold, you'll be taken to a campaign page, which allows you to email your congressman, to tweet your congressman, to put a Facebook message on your congressman, to write and call them. It gives you all the tools in order to be kind of an advocate for what we're talking about here, for regulation of internet poker and regulation of this activity for Americans. So we're hopeful that, we've already seen a tremendous uptick of our membership really get active over the last several months. We believe that this is a crucial year for this to get done. It's already happening at the state level, and we support that in most instances, but we believe that there should be a federal standard put in place so that all 50 states can, that choose to, can operate under a single system.
Right. And each of you, we got about 30 seconds left, just tell me what you think will happen within the next 6 months. Do you think something will happen, or is this going to go on and on and on?
Well, I think next 6 months is probably right to look at something that happened at the federal level. I would predict that if anything's going to happen, it's going to happen during the lame duck session. So that'll be after the elections and before the end of the year. So sometime late November, December, you could see some legislation moving through the House and Senate on this, because really that's quite honestly the only time anything's going to get done in Congress this year. But we're already seeing the states. Just yesterday, Delaware passed a bill, and which is going to be signed into law by the governor, he's already said so, that authorizes the state lottery to offer not only poker online, but all sorts of casino games on the internet to people who live in the state of Delaware. So that it's happening at a state level, and it's going to continue to happen at a more rapid pace the longer this drags on.
Right. Right. Well, we wish you good luck with the campaign to get regulation for online gabbing. And I suggest that our listeners who are really interested go to the Poker Players Alliance's website, http://thepaa.org, that's O-R-G. And you can go to our Artist First website for Crimebeat to get more information about the organization. John Pappas and Patrick Fleming, thank you so much for being on the show and giving us an update on this important issue.
Thank you very much for allowing us to speak, and let's hope it does some good, and let's hope things keep moving forward. And thank you again.
Right. Okay, thank you for being on the show. Yeah. Willie?
Well, thanks, Ronnie, and thanks again to our very special guests. The first guest was Terry Tariba, John Pappas, and Patrick Fleming. After the show, very fascinating look at online poker. We're delighted to have all three of them on our program tonight. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our show tonight?
Well, we had some really interesting guests tonight, two interesting topics. Terry Tariba has a fascinating book. We just touched the surface of Mickey Cohen's life, and I recommend our listeners go to buy a copy of her book. And, of course, it shows you how slow Congress moves, right? On the U.S. Congress on issues with this, because we were talking about this about a year ago. Really, nothing has changed, but the campaign has heated up, and with affecting millions of people. How about you, Willie?
Ronnie, I learned first of all, Mickey Cohen was a hood with nine lives. Quite the cat that guy was. You know, he started his life in a gutter, and it spilled over to the glitter and glamour of the 40s and 50s in L.A. What a character. He was the mobster superstar of his time. Quite the guy. Also, I learned that online poker playing is as popular as ever. You know, it's a recreation, and it's a basic freedom that people should have, and that's right. What it's really all about. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for July the 5th. We'll bring you a documentary film show special. Mr. Tommy Reed will be on to discuss his documentary film, Super Thief. A look at Phil Christopher, a career criminal, and one of the most successful bank burglars in U.S. history. We'll also bring you award-winning documentary filmmaker Mr. Yuri Lukovy and Professor Roman Serban, who will discuss Mr. Lukovy's documentary titled Genocide Revealed. It's the story of the man-made famine called the Holodomor, perpetrated by Joseph Stalin in 1932-1933, which reportedly killed upwards of 10 million Ukrainian citizens. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one, that's for sure. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsik and yours truly. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you there listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ronnie Chepsik and myself, Will Hareb, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.